KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. In the early 1970s, Peter Medak was an up-and-coming director who couldn't believe his luck when comedy legend Peter Sellers asked him to direct his next film, Ghost in the Noonday Sun. But this pirate caper movie quickly ran into so many troubles, with Sellers foremost among them.
I had no idea until the first day of shooting on the water, but then I learned it very quickly, you know. To have Peter on one side, then to have the boat, then to have the weather, then to have a crew of 130 people, you know, and to have no producer, because Peter fired the producers before we started shooting the film.
From the minute the crew arrived in Cyprus, the shoot was such a disaster that the experience haunts Medak to this day. He revisits that nightmare in the new documentary, The Ghost of Peter Sellers. But first on the news banter, Peacock unfurls its tail feathers. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Peacock, NBC Universal's streaming service, is coming online. People mocked Peacock, Matt, in the months when it was first announced. They were like, oh, it's just like not going to happen. It's free. It's too late. People aren't going to care about it. And I thought this from the start. I thought free is good. People love free. You have to watch some ads if you want it for free. But guess what? A lot of people have been trained to watch ads. And free, even if you haven't been trained to watch ads and you've been a person who's just been watching Netflix on your laptop, free is good. So I think there's a big audience out there and people who might like that comfort food programming. They'll have some originals, but they have a big library of familiar stuff that is just easy to watch in this stressful time like this.
Yeah. And, you know, they've been smart about the rollout of this. They're launching it with, you know, some pretty good content from the NBC platforms, 30 Rock, Law and Order. They'll eventually have The Office, which they paid a lot of money for. And they're pitching it expressly as the free alternative, because they know, and the Comcast people like to talk about this phrase, subscription fatigue, where there are all these services out there, Netflix, HBO Max, Quibi, Amazon Prime, all of these things cost money. And to put something out there that is the free alternative, it's a pretty smart alternative because, you know, like you said, there is this audience of casual viewers that they don't care about having the greatest, latest Emmy-winning thing that Hulu is offering. They don't care about that. They want just something fun, light to put on when they're home, and this could be it.
Yeah. I mean, we've been bantering for such a long time. I'd love to complain about my cable bundle and I don't want my cable bundle. And then it was always this looming thing that, okay, well, the cable bundle might go away and then you're going to have to pay for all these services. And here we are. And already with the, you know, the number marching onto the field, it feels like too much for, you know, it feels like at what point is it going to match what I'm paying for the cable bundle in the first place? So this, yes, I think we agree.
Well, and this will feel a little different from traditional cable television because the ad load is only going to be about 5 minutes per hour. Whereas if you watch an ad load on regular cable television, you're up to 20, 25 minutes sometimes on some of these networks.
Yeah, such a deal.
Yeah, that's going to feel different. And keep in mind that Comcast is not alone here in launching this. I mean, free ad-supported streaming is a segment of the streaming market that's only going to grow. We saw Fox buy a company called Tubi early this year, where they're looking to get into the free streaming business. Viacom CBS is also developing their own version of this. And I think, you know, as the cable world contracts and more people cut the cord, it's only going to expand in streaming, and you're going to have all different tiers of options for streaming television. And this is going to be a pretty big one, I think.
Yeah, I think we agree. For once, we agree, Matt. No, we often agree. I want to turn to Peter Lenkoff, a showrunner who was just fired at CBS. This guy was a big showrunner. He had done MacGyver, Magnum PI, Hawaii 5-0. And there had been many complaints about his conduct. And this, unlike some other issues at CBS, for once, there's not a sexual harassment charge that has been advanced at all so far. And I haven't heard one even whispered or gossiped about in the industry at this point. But the behavior was abusive and not harassment, but he was alleged to talk down to writers, especially women and people of color. So we're in a world now that was not okay before. And the social consciousness has shifted. And so it is super not okay now. And my sense is, you know, this means something because people like Peter Lenkoff, who issued a statement saying he was going to listen and learn and hopefully will, I think they're endangered in Hollywood finally after many years. I hope it's not temporary because being, you know, Time's Up started with sexual harassment issues, and there's plenty to continue in that regard. But there was also the general abuse issue that arose. And I think that, especially if you're dismissive of women and people of color, you're going to be an endangered species. I hope.
Yeah, you mentioned that it was not okay before, but it was tolerated. If you were seen as a creative talent, someone who delivered on the product, you could get away with a lot of bad behavior in Hollywood. And I remember having conversations with you a couple of years ago when the Me Too stuff was starting to happen, when we were speculating, we're like, okay, these are the harassers. These are the easy ones to identify and purge from the industry. When is it going to transfer over to the abusive people who are not sexually abusive, but who are taking advantage of their position to demean, to, you know, make people feel like they're in an intolerant work environment? And we know, you know, you and I could probably off the air, we could probably say a bunch of names that we know of people who have reputations for being abusive. And when is this movement going to come for them? And it seems with the Peter Lenkoff situation, it's starting to come for them.
Yes. On the other hand, FX just gave a deal to Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, and he had allegations against him that were supported by more than one person. You know, this is maybe a moment of coming back. I have to admit that I am surprised. I understand the mentality. John Landgraf runs FX. He is, you know, always called the smartest guy in the room when he talks in you know, at the critics gatherings or whatever. Yeah, FX has had to some degree a male sensibility. You know, they had Sons of Anarchy, they had Louis, they had Pam Adlon, but she came in with Louis C.K. And we know Louis C.K. has problems of his own in this regard. So, you know, I don't see where Matt Weiner has ever issued a real apology for the behavior that was alleged. It was more like, I don't remember doing any of that, which is, you know, for me, doesn't quite cut the mustard. I feel like, you know, this is going to be an issue if they want to premiere a show that he made. I don't know if the press will hold him to account, but if it were me, I can guarantee there would be questions.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people have mixed feelings about Matt Weiner. I mean, I'm one of the biggest Mad Men fans out there, but, you know, when I started to read this stuff about him, you kind of reassess, and, you know, there is a degree, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, there is a degree of allegations, and every instance needs to be evaluated on its own and not in the context of other allegations. But if there are credible allegations of an abusive work environment surrounding Matt Weiner, I think that's something that FX really should take into consideration when determining whether to hire him. Part of this new environment that everybody says that we are trying to create in this industry is one of more inclusiveness. And if you're going to do a deal with someone who has credible allegations of being abusive in the workplace, you got to take that stuff seriously.
I mean, I don't know what they did or didn't do, but they certainly didn't address it. And I don't, as I said, I don't know that Matt Weiner addressed it. And I feel like it's out of sync with what we were just talking about, because as you said, there will be more people who are likely to be called out for abusive behavior. And then to sort of go, oh, by the way, we're doing a deal with this one, and we're not going to mention that there were allegations. It just feels out of sync with where we are right now. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. coming up after a short break, 82-year-old Hungarian-born director Peter Medak on making a movie about the long-ago trauma of trying to shoot a film with the legendary Peter Sellers. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Ghost of Peter Sellers, now available on demand, is a portrait of a troubled and troublemaking comedian and the story of a film that never saw the light of day. It's also director Peter Medak's exploration of a traumatic experience that altered the course of his career. In the early 70s, Peter Sellers was huge, the star of Dr. Strangelove and The Pink Panther.
This is a very serious matter, and everyone in this room is under the suspicions.
Realm?
What? What was that?
You said realm.
Yes, I know that. And there is a very good chance that someone in this room knows more about the murder than he is telling.
Murder?
What was that you said?
I said murder.
What?
Peter Medak was fresh off directing The Ruling Class, a success at Cannes that earned Peter O'Toole an Oscar nomination. When Sellers approached him to direct Ghost in the Noonday Sun, a comedy about bumbling 17th century pirates, Medak was thrilled at first. The film, shot off the coast of Cyprus, was beset by a panoply of problems. The challenges of shooting on the water, for example. But perhaps the biggest problem was Sellers. Like many huge stars, he was known to be temperamental, but Medak was to learn just how extremely so. At one point, for example, Sellers faked a heart attack to get time off. That ruse became obvious when just 2 days later, he was seen dining in London with Princess Margaret.
What kind of person would fake a heart attack?
I mean, this is insane.
There is no way we can salvage this.
The film was never shown. My career nearly was completely destroyed.
Peter Sellers actually died of a heart attack not long after their final meeting. Peter Medak made other films and went on to direct episodes of The Wire, Hannibal, and Breaking Bad. But for him, The Ghost in the Noonday Sun was a lasting trauma that he believes affected his career.
Well, everybody was very worn out because it was 100-degree heat, and we were every day out at the Mediterranean on the boat, and everybody was seasick all the time and stuff like that, you know. So they wouldn't have been.
Yes, of course.
You know, but I mean, we were still having a lot of great, wonderful time. It's just that it didn't happen every day, but some of the days become a nightmare, depending on what mood Peter was in, or what the conditions were,
right,
or what we were shooting, you know. It's, you know, I mean, it was, I think, 87 days of shooting. I mean, Peter and I were great friends, you know, but that the kind of friendship gradually worn out itself.
It's the rare comedian who doesn't have that dark aspect, I think.
No, absolutely. But I mean, look at poor Robin Williams, you know, who was an absolute, complete, total genius, you know.
Yes.
You know, he had this very, very dark side. And I'm sure Charlie Chaplin had that too, you know. And certainly Peter Sellers had it, and he had that Peter O'Toole had it, and Spike Milligan had it, you know. And it's not just comedians, but I think it's all great actors. Slightly kind of touched by God in a way. I think all actors are. And it's a very difficult thing is to be a great actor, because what you're required to do to play these incredible characters on different movies and to make it 100% real, it's not an easy thing to do. And you have to be slightly crazy. And I mean, I think we are all slightly crazy, you know, directors, writers.
Yeah.
I mean, we all are, you know, and up to a certain point.
Well,
you know,
it's tremendous thing to make something out of an idea. Yeah, you're going on a tightrope with everything that you do. So how could you not be somewhat, you know, filled with anxiety and all kinds of, you know, turmoil when you're trying to make something. But Tom Hanks seems to be much of an exception. He's a great actor, and yet you never hear that sort of thing. But otherwise, you kind of hear it a lot.
Yeah, he's incredible, you know. But I mean, George C. Scott, I mean, he had a terrible reputation, much worse than Peter Sellers, you know. And he was a piece of cake to work for me with him. And he was the easiest actor to work with. You know, and so it's very, it's kind of unpredictable, you know?
Yeah. Well, the other factor that you had that was highly unpredictable was the water. being on the water is known, you know, to be a tremendous risk. I'm reminiscing again, but I remember when Jim Cameron was making Titanic, somebody said to me, they thought that was crazy to do a period piece on the water with Jim. Those three elements were, and I went down to watch them film, and they were, you had the same problem. You had to go 5 miles out to sea so that you wouldn't see the land.
Shore.
In
yeah.
his case, he put up these giant black screens to block the lights of the town in Mexico, and the wind was whipping and the screens were tearing, and it was complete madness at like 2 o'clock in the morning. The water is really challenging.
I know. I had no idea until the first day of shooting on the water. But then I learned it very quickly, you know, to have Peter on one side, you know, and Spike, then to have the boat, you know, then to have the weather, then to have a crew of 130 people, you know, and to have no producer. You know, because Peter fired the producers before we started shooting the film.
Yes. When Peter Sellers fired, one of the producers wrote a terrible letter, I think defensively, basically trashing you, though. Did you feel that was...
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't know. And John Heyman, who was the exec producer, who's David Heyman's father, unfortunately, he passed away after my interview. But that's John Heyman, who talks about how difficult Peter was, you know. And he and I really were great friends before this movie. But afterwards, you know, as I was blamed for everything, you know, we kind of avoided each other, and we didn't re-meet until about 3-4 years ago, when we did these conversations with each other about what happened on the movie.
The reports I got were that Peter Medak had not done his homework and that he was the person to blame for what was going on. And he said, there is no way we can salvage this film. And my instructions was to finish it and get out as cheaply as possible, deliver it, and let's all walk.
And it was very important for me to do that. And thank God we did it, because poor John passed away maybe a month after that, you know. And it was important that you have another opinion instead of just me talking about kind of trying to explain my side of the story. And I wanted to be very fair, you know, to the whole situation, because I loved Peter Sellers, you know, and I still love him after all this, what we've gone through. But I didn't want to just trash him all the time and put the blame on him, you know.
Yes.
And I mean, if Peter would walk in right now into my room, he would hug me and kiss me and wouldn't remember one single thing of it anymore.
And yet for you, it was just enormously traumatic. And I imagine you feel that it did damage your career.
Well, it did. I mean, of course it did, you know, because it should have been absolutely fantastic, the movie, you know. And the upset of it caused me much more problems than the business's opinion of me. Because after The Ghost in Noonday Sun, I worked on about 5 movies – And I managed to persuade myself eventually not to make any of those movies because I was so gun shy that if something wasn't right in the preparation of those five movies, I saw the signs immediately and I said, I can't do this, you know. And they were very important films, you know, with Sean Connery, Barbara Streisand, Richard Burton, Rod Steiger. And I should have made all of them. I just was damaged by it, no question about it. Then it would have happened to anybody.
Yes, I would imagine. I mean, I did a piece for the radio once about people who had big bombs and how they sort of processed the big bomb. And they were all very successful. Judd Apatow was one of the people, Akiva Goldsman and Laura Ziskin, who all were huge producers. It was wrenching every interview talking about realizing that your movie is failing very publicly.
No, absolutely. Because you never get rid of it. I mean, everybody keeps saying it's with an incredible cathartic experience for you to do this documentary. But I didn't want to make the documentary. I said, it's the last thing I want to do is go back into that nightmare and relive that. But then I suddenly thought after about a week of thinking about it, and I thought, you're crazy, just do it, because you can explain what happened and you can talk about the 70s of London and that whole incredible period and about Peter and Spike and all that. And I'm really glad I did it now, because it's been an incredible journey, you know. But I don't think it got rid of anything.
No, I thought maybe there was some catharsis in your encounter with John Heyman. I was going to ask you, what was the genesis? I had made an assumption that obviously is wrong, that you were the one who thought of doing this movie, the documentary.
No, it was Paul Aikabu, you know. He came across a photograph of this film and he got very fascinated by it and then researched it and realized it was this film which was the biggest movie ever made in Cyprus, and then realized it was a disastrous circumstances and all that. And then he got in touch with me out of the blue, and I asked him what he knows about it, and he told me, and I said, well, everything you tell me is all the wrong information, because that's not what happened. Mm. And then I started talking to him every morning at 6 a.m. on Skype between Los Angeles at the same desk where I'm sitting now. And we talked every day for about a month. And at the end of it, I said, look, I don't want to do it, you know. And he said, look, just think about it, you know. And then I did, and then I changed my mind. And then Paul raised the money himself privately from some friends and investors in Cyprus. And then the day came, I got on the plane and I went to London and I went to King's Road and started shooting.
Hmm. You're sort of directing yourself in the movie too.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to, you know.
Well, it seems certainly pleasant to have gone back to Cyprus. And the movie itself is, in a way, you know, you look at it and say, I wouldn't mind going to Cyprus.
Yeah. No, I had a wonderful time. I mean, very sad time at the same time. Because when you walk back to places where you shot everything, and as a director, you remember every frame of the film and every frame of what happened on the other side of the camera, you know, and who was behind it. And a lot of those people were wonderful, and they're not alive today anymore. And the locations are exactly the same. And it's just, it makes you very kind of ghost-like feeling. And that's why I decided to call it The Ghost of Peter Sellers, because it is not just the ghost of Peter, but the ghost of Spike and John Heyman and me, even though that I'm alive, because it is all these times which had gone by and it doesn't exist anymore, except the physical buildings are there, which is a very kind of ironic, strange, haunting feeling.
You did go on and you directed some on some of the most admired television series, Wire, Breaking Bad. I assume that was satisfying, and that, but at the same time now I read that you said you, as you get older, you don't get work, and it's pure ageism.
But yeah, but there's this insane mania in Los Angeles or in America about age. But all these companies and kind of producers, that they can't seem to understand that the older you are, the more you know and the more experience you have. And I mean, even when I was shooting this documentary, you know, I was climbing the mountains and the hills, trying to find the exact place where Peter had his heart attack, where he faked his heart attack. And none of the crew could keep up with me, because once I seen, oh, it's over there, you know, then, you know, you just start charging.
Well, is there a sort of a takeaway from the whole experience that you feel you would, if you were teaching a class or some young person came to you, would you say, I don't know, don't shoot on the water? You might say, don't shoot when the script isn't set. Don't shoot. Would you say, don't shoot with a crazy star? I don't know what.
No, I wouldn't say that, because tomorrow, if Peter would be alive and he would ring me, and he said, always used to call me darling when he wanted something. And he says, darling, you know, he said, I've got this thing, and I want you to read it, and I think we should make another movie. I would do it all over again, because I know it's a different time and it's a different day, and the circumstances would be different, and it wouldn't be the same, and I may be able to get away with it. And if I did, and if I could, it would be like the ultimate, really, winner. You know, for
there
me.
You have it. The Hollywood, that's what Hollywood runs on, that kind of thing right there.
But it does, because, I mean, the only thing what I keep saying to all young directors is to never, ever give up, because you can't give up. I will never give up. Even when I'm dead, I won't give up, you know. And the weird thing is that, yeah. No, the weird thing is that I felt really Peter and Spike's presence throughout the shooting of the documentary, that they were around me, really, still laughing their head off, which we always did. I mean, it was very painful sometimes, but we had incredible times when we on the floor in hysterical laughter about whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't all painful, but the film should have been a huge success, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't meant to be.
And it wasn't. And Columbia refused to accept it, you know.
Yes.
And poor John Heyman had to carry the bucket, you know.
Yes, he got stuck. But was it Gareth Wigan? Was Gareth at Columbia in those days? I saw his name on.
Yeah, it's the same Gareth, but Gareth was working for John Heyman.
Oh, okay. What a
at the time.
I'm just playing geography.
I know. And when the producers were fired, John sent Gareth out to be there somehow as a go-between and to keep the three lunatics, which was Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Peter Medak. He said, just keep peace between them and keep them going, you know.
Oh, dear.
Which darling Gareth did, you know, and he was a great friend. I mean, that was half of the trouble, that everybody was a great friend, because we knew each other from the 60s and the 70s of London, which was a magical time.
Peter Medak is the director of many films and television shows. His documentary, The Ghost of Peter Sellers, is now available on demand. Thank you for joining us.
My wonderful pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker and Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.